This is Glenn Hauser with Continent of Media 0502, recorded February 15, 2005, and to be released sometime later as World of Radio Extra 56. COM is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave, and is made possible by Universal Radio. For quality amateur and shortwave equipment, for a catalog, phone them at 1-800-431-3939 or check their website www.universal-radio.com. Universal also sponsors www.dxing.com, where you'll find much more info, including useful information for the beginning DXer and shortwave listener. Also, the latest edition of this program and an archive of DX listening digests. Clear Channel and some other major radio companies are forging ahead with commitments to convert more and more of their AM and FM stations to so-called IBOC, or high-definition digital radio. However, Rene Tetro, who works for WFIL in Philadelphia, says our company, which owns about 110 stations, is noticeably absent from those mentioned in a press release. In fact, I understand we have made it a conscious decision to hold off on IBOC. I'm glad. I know someday I'll have to deal with it, but I don't want to install that garbage on my stations any sooner than I have to. For those unfamiliar with this controversy, IBOC is quite an unpopular idea, especially for AM stations. Among listeners, do we count? Because it causes a station to take up three channels instead of one, with noisy interference to its neighbors. Some more comments about this also from the NRC AM list. Pat Griffith, imitating Andy Rooney, says, "The way I see it, IBOC is kind of like war. Nobody really wants it, but it does rally people on both sides together for a cause. It provides a boost to the manufacturing economy. And when it fails, we'll have some neat collectibles to show the grandkids in a few years. What's that, Gramps? It's an honest-to-goodness original IBOC generator, sonny." What the heck's an IBOC, Gramps? Following comments from Barry McLarnon in Ontario, who I believe is also a certified engineer, "Most radio listeners will be totally unaware of IBOC and its potential to cause interference. They'll probably write it off as a local noise problem and never complain to the affected stations. It's up to us IBOC-aware folks to let the stations know. I can't emphasize too much how important this is. Interference complaints are the only thing that can put the brakes on IBOC. Those who say it'll be a flop because hardly anyone will buy receivers may well be right, but they're missing the point. Clear Channel and other major ubiquity backers are investing a lot of money in converting their stations to IBOC. Once the investment is made, it costs them almost nothing to keep it on the air. Even if receiver sales are miserable, they'll keep it on for years, even decades. Perhaps they'll be lobbying the FCC to mandate that all new radios have IBOC capability. Who knows? No matter what happens in the marketplace, the transmissions will remain unless the stations are compelled to turn them off because of interference complaints. The complaint should go to the station being interfered with, but it won't hurt to also contact the station that is the source of the interference. You should identify yourself as a concerned radio listener, not a DXer. And you should make sure that you have some legitimate grounds for complaining. If you're receiving a station via Skywave, then there's not much point in complaining about IBOC interference to them unless they're a Class A Clear Channel station, since they're the only ones that have protection for Skywave service. You're on much firmer ground if you're in the groundwave coverage area of the station, especially if you're inside their protected contour. During daytime, stations are, in theory at least, protected from harmful interference out to their 1/2 millivolt per meter contours, or 0.1 for Class A. You can get a rough idea of where that contour is for a given station by looking it up on the website radio-locator.com. Nighttime interference is trickier to assess. "It's a faint hope, but at this point the AM band can only be saved by a grassroots movement led by listeners, plus the small station owners who realize how they're getting shafted by IBOC. Those of us in favor of public radio are not too happy that National Public Radio is one of the major backers of IBOC. Fortunately, this happens to concern mainly FM stations. Mike Jansen wrote an article in Current, brought to our attention by Tom Roche in mid-January. Digital booster NPR may buy 50,000 radios while adding program streams for added channels. National Public Radio may try to jumpstart sales of digital receivers this year by buying upwards of 50,000 radios to be resold to listeners. It's pitched the possibility of a group buy to all manufacturers of digital receivers, announced at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas in January. In another move supporting digital radio and the two-channel capacity that NPR advocates, the network said it will begin distributing four 24-hour programming streams in the coming months, the first by June. The FCC is expected to approve multicasting by July, and public radio stations have urged NPR to help get properly equipped receivers on the market. 50 NPR stations are broadcasting in digital. CPB has provided funding to help 262 more convert. The Digital Radio Advisory Panel at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has recommended devoting as much as $15 million to support stations' conversions to digital. It suggests giving aid first to broadcasters in the 50 largest markets and those serving large minority populations. On the shortwave programs list, Bill Bergadano says, "I thought I would never purchase a satellite radio, but now I'm considering it. Which would you recommend, Sirius or XM? Is there a vast difference?" Rich Cuff in Pennsylvania replies, "For a shortwave enthusiast, there is no comparison. Sirius provides vastly more diversity than XM. The only way I'd recommend XM to a shortwave enthusiast is if you want the infotainment BBC World Service stream, the one you hear on shortwave. That is the only real international broadcasting radio you hear on XM. But here are the international offerings on Sirius, the BBC World Service All News Feed, World Radio Network North America, includes RCI, Deutsche Welle, Radio Nederland, CRI, Radio Sweden, Prague, Australia, and a pile of others. Also CBC programming on the PRI World Channel. The CBC Sunday Edition, As It Happens, Ideas, DNTO, Dispatches. If the CRTC gives it blessing, there will also be CBC Radio 1 available to U.S. listeners. And as part of the subscription, Sirius offers webcasts of all its music streams. Most of these spoken word streams are available online elsewhere." And Rich Cuff concludes, "I would strongly recommend one of the plug-and-play models because that gives you the greatest variety of listening locations, home, car, or work." Again, that's referring to Sirius satellite radio. On the same list, here's an evaluation of CBC by John Filiozzi. "CBC is close in, easier to hear on medium and shortwave at least, and trumps much of what we hear on radio in the States, NPR and PRI being the notable and sole exceptions. CBC now has a lot of mediocre programming. I chalk this up largely, but not entirely, to drastic budget cuts over the last two decades. For example, the morning fare on CBC Radio 1 comes nowhere near the quality of the Morningside years, but that had a huge budget and put it to good use. The Current and Sounds Like Canada seem to suffer from a lack of resources, but also from a lack of a sound philosophical base and ideas. It seems management of CBC feels it must be all things to all people in order to protect its publicly derived budget. Too bad, using this approach means that most programs lack focus. The trend is toward magazines attempting to cast a wide net instead of more sharply designed and focused programs that identify a tighter audience. The entire schedule should piece by piece serve everyone it can, but not each and every program." Sandy Finlayson, a Canadian living in Philadelphia, replies, "The CBC is not quite where it used to be, but it's still pretty good. They had severe budget cuts in the last 10 to 15 years. They have never found anyone to replace the likes of Peter Zosky, Barbara Frum, Max Ferguson. The list could go on and on. In the case of Zosky, his retirement and death meant that the CBC lost a broadcaster who had the ability to make almost anything interesting. The CBC is sometimes engaged in change for the sake of change, which was not needed. I think Sheila Rogers should have been given the entire morning block on CBC Radio 1. However, they seem to feel that they needed to redesign the whole time period, which was unnecessary. All the redesign has done is spread their resources further. NPR is a good service, which I've come to appreciate since moving here a couple of years ago, but I think their output is even less consistent than CBC's, and there's no way NPR has the same reach or impact on American culture that the CBC has in Canada. Now some comments about digital television programming from the WTFDA list in late January. Carl Zuck, N2KZ, says, ABC News Now is off the air on WABC Digital 7, the second channel in their digital lineup. A slide is up saying WABC Now begins at midnight January 31st. Is this a local version of News Now, or are we reverting back to WABC reruns and old westerns? Scott Feibisch in New York says, I'm guessing reruns of WABC newscasts. In Washington, WJLA-DT is using the former News Now subchannel for local weather. And from Nashville, Doug Smith says, ABC News Now is also off of WKRN-2-2. They used to carry it squeezed up in the upper left with continuous weather in the rest of the screen. Continuous weather is still there with a live shot from their downtown camera on the so-called Bat Building, the Bell South Tower, squeezed up where ABC used to be. I've read on radioinfo.com that ABC has suspended News Now until later this spring. Dave Pomeroy in Kansas says, have ABC stopped providing ABC News Now? It had not even gotten to Topeka or Kansas City, except via Tropo DX, where I saw it on a couple of stations. If they have dropped it, I hope someone else will provide a 14-hour newscast using multicast channels. Then Carl Zuck replies, ABC News Now will continue as a web service and over cable. The issue here is union jurisdiction. NABET, a part of the CWA, claims jurisdiction over all programming emitting from ABC for over-the-air use. Digital television is over-the-air, so away it goes. Up to this point, it has been considered an experiment. I enjoyed it. It served as a good source of alternative programming. The talent had fun, and it was a great training ground to help break in ABC's farm team. The operation is really tiny. Their control room is right behind the huge three-projector screen on the Jennings set, and the studio is a tiny room with a green chroma key screen half a block away. Low budget, high fun. Sad to see it go, but it lives on via the net. Here's another intriguing idea from recnet.com, forwarded by John Brumall on the WTFDA list about Channel 6 sound broadcasting. Rec feels it's time for the community radio movement to consider the expansion of the FM broadcast band to include the spectrum currently used by TV Channel 6, 82 to 88 megahertz. When the FCC approved digital television, they granted all full-power stations a transition channel. This was a second channel that all stations can use to construct their digital facilities. At the end of the transition, TV stations are required to relinquish one of these two channels. Congress had reallocated channels 52 to 69 to commercial and public safety wireless interests. The remaining channels 2 through 51 are now referred to as the core channels. At the end of the transition, all TV stations will need to operate on channels 2 through 51. Why is Channel 6 better for FM radio? The main reason is desirability for the channel to be used for DTV. In many markets, since there were so many VHF stations on the dial, the only place where transition channels could be placed was in the UHF spectrum. Since these stations have already made a big investment in their DTV facilities on UHF, it would not make a lot of sense to completely remove their digital facilities and build new DTV facilities on VHF. And due to propagation characteristics of the low-band channels 2 through 6, DTV is not desirable there due to its lack of tolerance to noise and so forth. DTV Channel 6 stations would be required to protect non-commercial educational FM stations at 88 to 92 megahertz. Because of this requirement, the FCC did not allocate DTV Channel 6 to many communities. The most important reason is that the 30 FM channels that could be created out of the Channel 6 spectrum could hold a potential of thousands of new non-commercial community broadcast stations versus a small number of full-power and low-power TV stations. It's a good time to start going to your senator and representatives and urge them to start legislation that would remove TV Channel 6 from the core TV spectrum and reallocate it for the low and medium up to 1,000 watts in rural areas, local, non-commercial FM broadcasting. Localism in broadcasting and the domination of the media by large corporations is big news right now and may be a factor in future election campaigns. While the availability of FM receivers picking up 82 to 88 megahertz is scarce, in the future, the consumer electronics industry, either voluntarily or through legislation, could make FM tuners available in the U.S. In Japan, the broadcast band already spans 76 to 92 megahertz, which are TV channels 5 and 6 here, so the technology to make a radio that tunes down to 82 megahertz is already available. In fact, IGH have one such portable radio I picked up in Japan some 35 years ago, but about the only use it's been over here is listening to audio from Channel 5. You're listening to Continent Media 0502. Our address, P.O. Box 1684, ENID OK, 73702 USA, or WORADIO at yahoo.com. Your comments and contributions always welcome. Mike Cooper sends a Voice of America press release of January 5th. The Leo Sarkisian Library of African Music, a rare collection of indigenous African music, donated to VOA by the internationally known broadcaster, musician, and ethnomusicologist, will become available to scholars in the spring of 2005. Sarkisian 84 amassed the collection during nearly 50 years of traveling and broadcasting to Africa, where he interviewed musicians and compiled a unique collection that reflects the continent's broad heritage of traditional and popular music. The collection includes recordings presented to him both by African radio stations and ordinary Africans for broadcast on his long-running VOA radio show, Music Time in Africa, which, by the way, is still to be heard Sundays at 17:30 and 19:30 UT in two different editions. Thanks in part to such contributions, his personal collection grew to include more than a myriad of reel-to-reel tapes, plus records, cassettes, and CDs. The library will not only conserve archival materials for research and scholarship, but also establish a website to serve the needs of VOA programmers, academic scholars, and researchers. The library is located at VOA headquarters in the Cohen Building, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room G108. From KimAndrewElliott.com, January 26th, he says, new major white paper on public diplomacy by a distinguished panel du jour. Public Diplomacy Council calls for a billion here, a billion there. It seems that these thoroughgoing papers with solutions for the failure of U.S. public diplomacy are being issued about once a month. A call for action on public diplomacy is from the Public Diplomacy Council, housed at George Washington University, consisting largely of alumni, feminine plural, of the disbanded U.S. Information Agency. It calls for $1 billion for exchange programs, a gigadollar for international broadcasting, and a sesquijagabuck for salaries and expenses. It recommends creations of a U.S. agency for public diplomacy, part of the State Department but semi-autonomous like the U.S. Agency for International Development, headed by the equivalent of a Deputy Secretary of State. The report suggests perhaps the time has come to merge all U.S. international broadcasting into a single, adequately funded, comprehensive, full-service, multimedia global broadcaster that maintains the principles laid down in the VOA Charter as well as its journalistic code. Kim interjects, I recommended this 15 years ago in Foreign Policy, Winter 1989-90, an article titled Too Many Voices of America. He goes on, the council also calls for the restoration of a 24-hour VOA English service. But the tricky part, it wants the Broadcasting Board of Governors to be more closely attuned to foreign policy while also maintaining its journalistic independence. Now some items about the transmitters and studios of major domestic radio stations. Jeff Weston forwards to the BDXC UK group an item from the website of WOR 710 in New York about their new transmitter site, signed by their corporate director of engineering, Thomas R. Ray III. The WOR transmitter facility has been in Lyndhurst, New Jersey since 1967. It was built upon what was at one time a dump. The state of New Jersey will be developing this land along with the remainder of several dump sites that extends approximately 2,500 acres from Lyndhurst south. The development will include at least three 18-hole golf courses, approximately 600 housing units, at least two hotels, two office buildings, a train station off the Bergen Line, and numerous other things. As part of this redevelopment, WOR will be completely rebuilding our transmitter facility on a piece of virgin swamp, approximately 2,500 feet north of our present location. Come back often and check our progress through this online photo album. Soon we'll be offering a unique perspective on the construction of our transmitter facility, courtesy of the publication Radio World. Well, their own website about this is www.WOR710.com/TX_construction.shtml. Next, from Ben Dangerfield in Wallingford, Pennsylvania, on the NRC AM list. In the middle 30s, I visited the transmitter site of KDKA, which was then at Saxonburg, Pennsylvania. I was just a teenager, but was impressed by all the wood towers, some of which were for KDKA's shortwave relay W8XK. Also enjoyed all the gadgets in the transmitter building. Saxonburg is about 20 miles from downtown, and just around that same time I visited the KDKA studios in Pittsburgh's Grant Building on the night of their dedication. Truly a unique station, a pioneer, they had their own studio orchestra and vocalists and studio players, and they broadcast messages to the far north on Saturday nights. Bill Smith in Iowa tells DX Listening Digest, radio station WHO 1040 in Des Moines will soon move from the studios it's occupied since 1932. The new studios, a short distance from the old, are state-of-the-art equipped, three times the size of those used for 73 years, and will commence use in March. Since WHO began broadcasting in April 1924, this is only the third ever studio location. When WHO first went on the air, the 500-watt transmitter, aerial, and studios were all on the top floor of the Liberty Building in downtown Des Moines. On April 22, 1933, the 50,000-watt transmitter went on the air from the Mitchellville, Iowa site. It was connected to a wire antenna which stretched about 750 feet, supported by two 300-foot towers. That transmitter site remains in use today, although the original transmitter and tower have long since been replaced. Bill Smith also forwards a story from the Dallas Morning News. KRLD to leave ballpark. Radio station will move back to Dallas this summer, by Steve Quinn. KRLD AM 1080, the news and talk station that broadcasts Texas Rangers games, will move its offices from Ameriquest Field in Arlington to the Fitzhugh Central Building in Dallas this summer. The parent company Infinity Broadcasting of New York said it wants to put all its six Dallas area radio stations in one location. KRLD's vice president and general manager, Jerry Bobo, says, I hate to leave this beautiful facility, but it makes sense for all the stations to be in one location. Mr. Bobo will trade a view of home plate from offices above left center field for one that overlooks the city's uptown area at the southwest corner of Fitzhugh Avenue and North Central Expressway. Mentioned previously on World of Radio was a station in American Samoa, emulating, at least by call letters and I think by format, KHJ in Los Angeles. But here is another one, a low-power station in Oregon. David Williams in Redmond, Oregon, near Bend, told us about it on the WTFDA list. I know quite a few of you are into classic radio from the 60s and 70s. Here in Central Oregon, we've got an interesting low-power FM, KHJA LP 102.1 in Madras. Or is that Chennai, or do they pronounce it Madras? Anyhow, it IDs as KHJ and clones the format of Boss Radio KHJ Los Angeles from that time period, the 60s and 70s, with a top 40 format from that era. Check out their website, www.khjfm.com. They actually have some of the original jocks doing shows for them now, including Big Bob Anthony and Pat St. John. Just add on slant Boss Jocks to that website just given. Incidentally, Big Bob Anthony co-founded EMF, that is, K-Love and Air One, the Christian Broadcasting Networks, yetch, at least they didn't make this LP one of them. The website explains why we are attempting to recreate 93 KHJ Los Angeles. Unfortunately, there is no sign of a web stream from this one, unlike the one in Samoa. On the NRC AM list, there was a fascinating stream about railroad tracks started by Paul Smith, W4KNX, in Sarasota, Florida. Has anyone tried DXing from a mainline railroad track? I swear a track extends the ground signal of a station considerably. When I was in Boise, Idaho, I parked next to a mainline track and could hear KSL in Salt Lake City real good in the daytime. And when I moved a couple hundred feet away, KSL was gone. That was the track that led directly to Salt Lake. I've noticed it here in Florida, too. It would be cool. Use the old phone line next to the track as the antenna, and the track itself as the ground. I bet it would really perform. Rene Tetro, a chief engineer in Philadelphia, replies, I've done it, and it really does work, and it works on the transmission end as well. I was once working at a small 1 kilowatt AM radio station whose towers were adjacent to a set of tracks. As an experiment, I took some 2-inch copper strap that I had in storage and ran it from the ground ring at the base of the tower closest to the tracks and connected it to the bottom of one of the rails with a small C-clamp via a large 0.1 microfarad 600-volt capacitor to prevent any interference with rail signaling. The result was that the rails effectively became a part of the station's antenna and ground system. I checked with a field strength meter before and after and found that when I came within 500 to 1,000 feet of the rails, our field strength was about 10 to 20% greater than without the rail connection. I was also able to hear the station much further away than normal when I came near the rails. I know it isn't exactly kosher, but my curiosity got the better of me. I was young and stupid. I removed it 2 days later, and our signal went back to normal. And the cap did indeed protect the rails' signaling circuitry. It operated flawlessly during the 2 days I was connected. I kept a close eye on the nearby signals and a close ear on the railroad's radio frequencies while I was experimenting. Today I am older and wiser and would not try such a thing, and nor would I ever recommend that someone else try it. The railroads are also much more attuned to people on their property, and one would probably get arrested. But if you live near some abandoned tracks, it might be interesting to see how a rail-based pseudo-beverage antenna might work. Peter Jernikoff of DuPont Technologies in Delaware replies, I recall the same phenomenon when going under an occasional overpass with a radio on. This may be the result of stochastic resonance, a phenomenon whereby a coherent input is amplified and optimized with the assistance of noise. The train tracks and the steel bridge beams may be funneling RF energy into the radio, which serves as the amplifying noise. Or not, I'm a chemist, not a physicist. Has anyone else observed these effects or can offer a better explanation? I have a long paper on the theory of stochastic resonance, if anyone's interested. Glenn Hauser concluding Continent of Media 0502, also known as World of Radio Extra 56.